loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, in a confidential 20-page letter to the special counsel, President Trump's attorneys argue that he cannot be compelled to testify in the Russia investigation, and he cannot be indicted for obstruction of justice because he has unfettered authority over all federal investigations. The letter apparently was leaked to the New York Times by someone in Robert Mueller's special counsel office. We're going to talk about this in our first segment. And then, the United States is inching closer to imposing economic sanctions on European Union companies that do business with Iran or that are engaged in the construction of the new Nord Stream 2 pipeline that would deliver gas to the EU and EU countries from Russia. Meanwhile, the Chinese government has rebuked Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross's attempts to secure further trade concessions from the country.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, at least 33 people died yesterday when Guatemala's Fuego volcano erupted, spewing ash, rock, and gas into the sky just 25 miles from the capital of Guatemala City. It's the country's deadliest volcanic eruption since 1902. Could residents have been better prepared? Next, Jordan's King Abdullah replaced Prime Minister Hani Malki today in an attempt to appease Jordanians who are protesting IMF-backed reforms that have hit the country's poor particularly hard. The government also plans to end taxes that have brought thousands of people into the streets in the capital of Amman. Then we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And then we continue our weekly segment called Connected Lives, Private Profits with Chris Garafa. Chris will help us look at technological issues that shape the world and how we can fight to maintain our civil rights and civil liberties in the face of increasingly advanced and sometimes hostile technology. And finally, the Yemeni army is on the verge of recapturing the coastal town of Hodeidah, which was taken over by Houthi rebels in 2014. The port's capture would effectively cut off supplies of arms and ammunition to the Houthis, and it would severely limit the Houthis' ability to fire rockets at Saudi Arabia. It was Hodeidah's capture in 2014 that led to the Saudi invasion of Yemen. And in other headlines, in a narrowly worded decision, the Supreme Court today sided with the Colorado wedding cake baker who didn't want to serve a gay couple, citing religious freedom. The decision was worded as being a mere correction of the Colorado Civil Rights Commission that heard the argument and not a landmark decision. The court said, quote, "The outcome of cases like this in other circumstances must await further elaboration in the courts," unquote. Japanese Finance Minister Taro Aso announced that he will be returning his full salary for the last year in response to a growing scandal over a sweetheart deal given to a right-wing nationalist private school with ties to Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's wife, Aki. Officials in Aso's finance ministry are accused of doctoring records that would have implicated Abe. Aso is a close ally of Abe and has said that he will not resign. UK Prime Minister Theresa May called President Donald Trump today to voice her opposition to controversial trade actions by the administration. According to the UK government, quote, "The Prime Minister raised the US decision to apply tariffs to EU steel and aluminum imports, which she said was unjustified and deeply disappointing," unquote. Tariffs on EU goods have driven a wedge between the United States and its allies in Europe. In the first day of the Organization of American States General Assembly, the U.S. pushed for Venezuela to be kicked out of the OAS group. Although President Maduro has already said he's planning to leave, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo encouraged the group today to register a protest against last month's election, despite widespread assurances from many international observers that it was free and fair. Those are today's headlines. Next up is an analysis of the current status of the Mueller investigation. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the latest in the Mueller, a so-called Russia probe. In a confidential 20-page letter to the special counsel, President Trump's attorneys argue that he cannot be compelled to testify in the Russia investigation, and he cannot be indicted for obstruction of justice because he has unfettered authority over all federal investigations. The letter apparently was leaked to the New York Times by someone in the special counsel Robert Mueller's office. We're joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer who is the author of The Plot to Attack Iran, amongst other works. We're also joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. And we're joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf, an investigative reporter, a columnist for Counterpunch, and a contributor to Businessweek, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. Welcome to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Good to be here.
Let's begin, Jim Cavanaugh, with you. I'm reading from the New York Times on June 2nd. In a brash assertion of presidential power, the 20-page letter sent to the special counsel Robert S. Mueller III and obtained by the New York Times contends that the president cannot illegally obstruct any aspect of the investigation into Russia's election meddling because the Constitution empowers him to, quote, if he wished, terminate the inquiry or even exercise his power to pardon, close quote. There's quite a number of important pieces all located within that single paragraph from the New York Times. But let's start with the process itself. This letter, a confidential letter from Donald Trump's attorney to the special counsel, obtained by the New York Times. Well, Jim Cavanaugh, what does that suggest?
I have no idea. I presume it came from the special counsel's office. It's usually the prosecutor's office that does the leaking in criminal investigations to try and spin things their way. I don't see any rationale for Trump lawyers to leak it. You know, when I read through the thing, it's a legal document. It's a legal argument, and people are again confusing political and criminal crime and legal crimes. The president does have the constitutional authority to fire anybody he wants and to stop any investigation he wants. Whether that's something that substantively would be considered obstruction of justice in a political sense is for the Congress to decide if they want to impeach him. So everybody's getting these things all confused. How could he possibly say he has the power to do? Well, he does, but Congress can impeach him if they want for doing that, whether it's constitutionally his prerogative or not.
Dan Kovalik, I mean, there was a reason that Trump's lawyers, the letter comes from John Dowd, no longer one of Trump's lawyers. There's a reason they hand delivered the letter to Robert Mueller's office, and that was they were trying to avoid it being on email, being hacked. Does it say anything to you about the possible corruption of the Mueller team itself? I mean, what about that?
Well, it's certainly suggestive of a lack of independence. You know, Mueller is certainly out to get Trump, that you know, he's not dispassionate in what he's doing to leak this type of memo, which, as you say, the Trump team went to great pains to get to them in the most secure way.
Would it be illegal? Would it be illegal to leak it to the New York Times?
Well, I don't know that it would be illegal because it's not classified information. I think it may be unethical, but I don't know if it would be illegal.
Okay, and Dave Lindorf, your take on all that?
Well, it wouldn't be illegal because it's not. What's illegal is for a prosecutor to leak anything or a party to leak something from a grand jury investigation. But this is not a grand jury investigation. It's just an investigation. And prosecutors can play politics. They can leak stuff from their investigations anytime. But I agree. It raises questions about impartiality. But then again, in the world we live in America, prosecutors are nobody sees prosecutors as being independent and impartial. They're out to win, and so it's what's being done by Mueller is what's done by prosecutors across the country. I think what's more interesting to discuss is how this is a Washington political battle where, you know, you've got the White House trying to discredit the investigation and to get it terminated, and you've got the special prosecutor trying to defend preemptively his authority to continue the investigation. So it's all politics, I think. And Dan's right. I think it was Dan who was saying this, that that, you know, in the end, we're not talking about crimes. We're talking about impeachable issues, which are not crimes necessarily, just like they mentioned in the letter that in one of the comments by the Times reporters who annotated the letter, that, you know, a president can be accused of obstruction of justice in an impeachment, even for lying to the American public, as Nixon was in one of the articles that was voted out.
You know, it seems to me that regardless of the bad faith on one side or both, this is going to have to be adjudicated in the courts. It reminds me very much of Watergate. Even though I was young when Watergate was playing out, I was old enough to understand it and appreciate it and follow the story. And it seems to me that we're seeing a little bit, at least, of history repeating itself here, and that eventually this is going to have to end up in the courts, because you've got people like Rudy Giuliani running around saying that the president can't be charged with a crime. And I think the president probably can be charged with a crime, but the courts are going to have to decide on that. And he's saying that the president absolutely can pardon himself. Well, he probably cannot pardon himself. But again, it's something that judges, I think, are going to have to weigh in on.
Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, this is you're absolutely right. I mean, I think most of us feel like a president can't pardon himself, but I'm not sure it's a question that's ever come up or
exactly
presented to a court. So, you know, as you say, in the end, the judiciary is going to have to decide that. It may have to decide some of these subpoena issues. If there is an indictment, I'm certain that will be adjudicated. So, and as you say, this has a certain Nixonian quality to it, and we're going to have a huge constitutional crisis that's going to evolve from this.
I don't think this is going to go to the courts of the Supreme Court in that sense. I think this is a political game disguised as a litigation, again, disguised as a criminal thing. I think they want to play this out with these kinds of leaks now and then, and they just want to hobble, keep the discipline. This is disciplining Trump, and they're going to keep it going. You know, if Trump ever comes to trial for a crime, it'll be because of some financial shenanigans after he's either impeached or leaves office. But they want to just keep the pressure on him. And I don't know where they're going to go with this legally.
Let's talk about Andrew McCabe. Is he going to be indicted? You expect a prosecution of Andrew McCabe, who, of course, was the person overseeing the Hillary Clinton investigation, then partly or maybe significantly responsible for the Russian investigation led at that time by James Comey. Now he's been fired for impropriety right before he was due to retire. Criminal referrals have gone to the FBI's IG, Inspector General. Dave Lindorf, will McCabe be prosecuted?
If I were a betting man, I would say he will probably face some kind of charge for lying, and that, you know, that could be interesting, but it'll also be hard to prove, and it'll be it's a way of damaging the investigation. So I'm sure we'll see some effort to do that. That would be my bet. I mean, he's the best thing they've got, you know, on the Trump side to discredit the FBI.
Yeah. What about, let's ask any of you who want to take a stab at this, will James Comey be indicted for, say, leaking the memos? I mean, when he was meeting as Donald Trump's director of FBI, meeting confidentially or meeting privately, at least, with Donald Trump, he then admits that he leaked the memorandum to a friend so that friend could give it to the media so that the media could get Comey's side of the story out. What about that? Is that prosecutable? Anybody have a take on that?
I don't think so.
Why?
It's not. Just because the president has a confidential conversation doesn't make it a national security secret. I mean, there's no leaking conversations is like, I mean, my God, if that was criminal, everybody in Washington would be going to jail.
Amen to that.
That's true, actually.
Yeah. I mean, he can be fired for it because they don't like what he did, but I don't see the criminality.
Well, let me go. I think, Jim, you were the one who said you don't think this is going to the courts, that this is really just a pressure campaign on Trump. I want to explore that a little bit. What would be the goal of the pressure campaign exactly? And also, it does take place within this larger sort of backdrop, the political or strategical backdrop of intensifying antagonism with Russia. And we now have expanded NATO military exercises taking place. A lot's going on the in terms of actual geostrategic competition between the United States and Russia. Dan Kovalik, how do you see it? Is it just pressure on Trump, or does it have some ultimately like a geopolitical goal here?
Well, I certainly think that the whole Russiagate issue does have the goal of keeping the U.S. at odds with Russia. I think the big fear of one of the big fears of a Trump presidency was that he might make nice with Russia, and that is a threat to certain folks in Russia, particularly those in the military-industrial complex. And so I do think that that is part of the goal here. But I think there's other goals of other reasons, certainly to hate Trump, and that people do hate Trump. And I think he is seen as illegitimate in general, that he got to the presidency in an illegitimate way. You know, he basically leapfrogged over the usual ways of being vetted and approved by a party to become president. And I think people resent him. And I think part of what's happening is they want to really undermine any authority that he has, and maybe force a resignation or certainly hobble him so he's not reelected in 2020. I think that's also probably the bigger goal here.
One of the things that frightens me a little bit is that this whole process has become so politicized that it's going to corrupt itself. And what I mean by that is that when a president is accused of committing a high crime or misdemeanor, an impeachable offense, he is impeached, or there's an impeachment vote in the House of Representatives. And then if the impeachment vote is successful, then he goes on trial in the U.S. Senate. But I think that we're getting so polarized and so politicized on this specific issue that no matter what he does, even if it's grossly impeachable, I think a Republican-controlled House will refuse to take it up.
Oh, yeah, I think that's absolutely true.
And the basis for a reasonable political impeachment process, really, as you say, John, that we saw, I guess, in some sense with Nixon, isn't there in the same way. And it's just becoming a huge waste of political time and energy that everybody's going to be going through. You can see it's not going to stop for a long time. And I don't see how it can be impeached, as you say. And unless he's impeached, they're not really going to bring him to trial unless they find he murdered somebody, you know? I mean, and then he will be impeached.
Okay, just because you mentioned about even if he killed somebody, why did Giuliani actually go out and say, even if Donald Trump shoots James Comey in the street, he can't be indicted? I mean, why are Trump and Giuliani talking like this?
They're jerks. They're really stupid. They have put themselves in the worst possible position.
Could it be that simple? Could we just be dealing with jerks, stupid?
They're echoing Trump from when he said, I could walk out in the street in Times Square and shoot somebody and I'd still get elected. He, or my people would still support me. It's this juvenile image that they have about, I can shoot people and you can't stop me, you know, and they're playing with it. But I guess my sense is that what we're going to see is, as long as the Democratic Party, and I'm talking about the establishment Democratic Party, DNC, and the congressional, what is it called, DCCC or whatever, think that going after Trump is the way to win back Congress, which they think it is, then they're going to keep doing this. And if they do win back control of the House, they're going to see it as having been a successful strategy, and they'll probably continue it and just, you know, try to continue to hobble Trump, which they then can do better if they have a Democratic House. So regardless of what happens in the Senate, there's not ever going to be an impeachment because, I mean, a removal of the president, because the Senate is not, if it turned Democratic, it would be very, very narrow. And even that's in question. So you're not going to have in any stretch of the imagination, a 2/3 vote in the Senate to remove Trump. So it's all about hobbling him. And I think that if the Democrats are successful in taking the House, we're just going to see this continue on through 2020, whether it succeeds or not, and keeping him from being elected to a second term. I think that's going to be more what happens to the economy and whether he starts another war or whatever. But the successful strategy is going to be seen as a successful strategy, or a failed strategy will be, you know, if the House stays Republican, I think you'll see all this impeachment stuff just die down.
A political struggle masquerading as a legal contest. That was the voice of Dave Lindorf. We're joined by Dave from Philadelphia. He's an investigative reporter, a columnist for Counterpunch, and a contributor to Businessweek, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. We're also joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer. He's the author of The Plot to Attack Iran. And we're joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh, who is the editor of thepolemicist.net. John Kiriakou, if our guests are right, that this is politics dressed up as a legal proceeding, if it's designed to hobble Trump or to limit Trump or to use as leverage against Trump, whatever the cause may be, this isn't, in spite of Donald Trump's sort of, I don't know, Pollyannish feelings that this was about to go away 6 months ago, this isn't going to go away because there's no history of special counsel investigations being short-lived.
No, you're right. And in fact, if this investigation is going to be like any of the previous investigations of the last two generations, this has just begun. And I'll give you an example. Going back to the Reagan years, Michael Deaver, who was special counsel to the president, his perjury charge investigation went for 3 years. Iran-Contra went for 6.5 years. Samuel Pierce, who was the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development under George H.W. Bush, his investigation went 8.5 years. Whitewater, 7.5 years.
That was against the Clintons.
Whitewater against the Clintons. Mike Espy, the Secretary of Agriculture, that one went for 7.5 years. Henry Cisneros, also under Clinton, 8.5 years. Even Valerie Plame, which was a very straightforward issue, lasted for more than 3 years. And so this Russia investigation, it's only been but a year or so. There's a potential for this thing to drag on, I mean, well through the Trump presidency.
Although this is a different kind of counsel. You know, those counsels were chartered to fire under the special counsel statute.
Yes, which has since lapsed.
I think John's right, though, that this is designed to go on and on. Jim Kavanaugh, it says a lot about the form of governance in the United States. I mean, here you have the biggest economy in the world, the largest military in the world, the leader of the sort of at least the capitalist world, and yet hobbled so severely by a form of governance whereby the leading and two dominant political parties spend almost all of their time, almost all of their energy focused on carrying out what is essentially political attacks masquerading as legal struggles against each other. Meanwhile, you have, you know, rising technological trends and advances in China and elsewhere. The United States doesn't seem to be on the cutting edge of any of that, just sort of bogged down in this kind of governance.
Yeah, this does demonstrate, I think, a lot of the problems with the constitutional order we have and why we shouldn't be worshiping the Constitution. It's clearly a document that was set for, that structured a situation which was as anti-democratic as it could be, posing as democratic. You have the Electoral College, the checks and balances system. There might be good aspects to these things, but you're beginning to see how the extent to which they're in place in order to block any kind of radical change. That it gives little pockets in the red legislature, in the judiciary, where no government can come in and change something. And we might not like the idea of Donald Trump's government doing that, but there's always a possibility for what's essentially the powers that be or the ruling class to prevent the changes that the people might have voted in. And this is something we've got to look at very carefully. And I think that's what's going on here. And they use the law all the time. They use little legal arguments all the time, whether it's the Supreme Court or not, to try and win political victories that they cannot win politically. And that goes for people so on the left, so to speak, as well as on the right. Ireland had a vote on abortion rights in one of the most conservative countries on that subject in the world, and it won by 66%. They got 66% of the people to vote for it. The United States, abortion rights was won because liberals went to the Supreme Court and got the Supreme Court to do it for them. They didn't, and they didn't have the conversation with those 50 million people out there. You know, they didn't change their minds. So you're stuck with this now. It's a very tricky thing that we have to look at very carefully.
Those are really, really important points. Dan Kovalik, I want to get your comments on that, too, because in a way, like, we're all opponents of Trump, his odious policies. Different parts of the elites hate Trump, perhaps for their own reasons. But nonetheless, when we're talking about this kind of governments, the inertness, the sort of, I don't know what the right description is, but it's just paralyzed on all things that are meaningful, and with the exception, perhaps, of the military budget. And yet this is the way of Washington.
One signal that the republic is dead. You do not have a functioning democracy. You know, there was an MIT economist just came out and said that we have now devolved into a developing nation. We're not a developed nation anymore.
What's the opposite of developing? Maybe we should use that as the language, the counter-developing.
Yeah, we're now a third world country. You know, and meanwhile, these games are playing on Capitol Hill. A hill is a form of fiddling while Rome burns, you know. We have homelessness. We have these huge social problems. And again, as you say, all they do is politically snipe at each other. We do not have a functioning democracy, and that is a fact, and it is very depressing.
Yeah, that's the fact. I mean, we're out of time, but it actually doesn't work. It's not working. It doesn't really represent the needs of the people or the needs of society. It doesn't have a forward-looking capability. It's just that the American power and the American economic power is so bloated that the ship hasn't sunk already. But nonetheless, it's a sign of where things are going. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik, human rights and labor lawyer. He's the author of The Plot to Attack Iran, amongst other works. We've been joined from New York City by Jim Cavanaugh. Jim is the editor of thepolemicist.net, and from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf, an investigative reporter, a columnist for Counterpunch, and a contributor to Businessweek, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
The United States is inching closer to imposing sanctions on European Union companies that do business with Iran or that are engaged in the construction of the new Nord Stream 2 pipeline that would deliver gas to EU countries from Russia. Meanwhile, the Chinese government has rebuked Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross's attempts to secure further trade concessions from China. We're joined from the United Kingdom by John Ross. He is an award-winning resident columnist with several Chinese media organizations, and he has over 200 articles published on China and the international economy. John Ross, welcome back to Loud and Clear. It seems that the Trump administration has declared a trade war de facto with everyone, adversaries and allies alike. Again, what will this mean for Europe and Europe's relationship with the United States? I mean, of course, the European Union could retaliate, is retaliating. But there's been this long-standing post-World War II alliance between the United States and those European Union countries that constitute sort of junior partners of a U.S.-led military alliance, NATO. Anyway, what's your take on what's going on?
Well, I think there's two different aspects to it. One is what you might call the geopolitical military, which is the strategic goal of various U.S. administrations since World War II has been to separate Western Europe from Russia. Now, I say Russia because they first, of course, separated Western Europe from the Soviet Union, but they've continued that policy under Russia. And there's a very strategic thinking behind that, which is that Europe and Russia to Western Europe and Russia together is a more important economic center than the United States. The European Union by itself has a larger GDP than the United States, but it not so self-sufficient in energy, raw materials, and other matters as is the United States. So therefore, if the Western Europe were to get together with Russia, then that would be a more powerful economic center than the United States. So therefore, U.S. strategy has been to make sure there's a division between Russia and Western Europe, and this policy has been going on since World War II. And it's fairly effective because there would have to be a significant change in German foreign policy, for example, to back down that U.S. type of threat. So that's the first thing, and I don't necessarily expect an extremely rapid move on that front, although there may be some. And the second point, however, is economic, and here I do think the U.S. is running into some serious problems because Germany is a very considerable economic power, and China has become now the largest trading partner of Germany in the entire world. So therefore, Germany is not going to be messed around on the purely economic front. And of course, this has an effect on the political atmosphere inside Germany, because people inside Germany consider that the United States, with the steel tariffs and even the threats on cars, etc., is directly acting against the interests of Germany. So therefore, there is a significant political shift of undermining the support for what you might call subordination to the United States inside Germany. So, but nevertheless, what you might call the geopolitical, military, and the economic are not quite in sync with each other, although they interact.
We're going to be joined in a few minutes by Rainer Braun. Rainer is the co-president of the International Peace Bureau. He's going to join us from Ramstein, Germany. But before he does, John, I wanted to ask you how these sanctions are playing in China. The U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross was in China very recently over the weekend, and he was there to talk about tariffs. How are the Chinese reacting to these tariffs?
I think that the U.S. actions have caused a very, very great change in attitudes in China towards the United States. You have to understand that there is a specific historical background to the situation of the appreciation of the United States and China, which is constituted by the Second World War, because during the Second World War and prior to it, of course, Japan was invading China. And in the war against Japan, the United States was an ally of China. And this is still remembered, and many people consider that the United States played a decisive role in the defeat of Japan, and therefore this aided China greatly. So you may say there is a historical legacy of goodwill towards the United States, which exists in China. The second is, of course, there were relatively good relations between the United States and China following Nixon's famous visit to China. So traditionally, there has been rather goodwill. This is in addition to people who are just rather cravenly supporting the West and so on and so forth. The actions by the United States over the question of tariffs, and also, incidentally, the infamous phone call with Taiwan, which Trump made, and his implicit attempt to undermine the One China policy, although he was forced to then retreat on that, has led, I think, to a very seismic shift in opinion in China regarding the policies of the United States, or at least this U.S. administration. And I'm rather active on China's social media. I've got over 800,000 followers on Weibo, which is the Chinese equivalent of Twitter. And I know by following that this is a really, really big shift. People think that this is a completely unnecessary, unjustified attack on China. They think it's an attempt to block China's advance towards a high income economy by developing its high technological sector. They consider this is completely unjustified, and I think this has produced a big, sharp turn in public opinion in China towards the policies of the U.S. administration.
We're speaking with John Ross from the U.K. John, what's in a specific and practical terms, what's China going to do in response to these threats and sanctions and tariffs?
Depends what the United States does. China has made it absolutely clear it does not want a trade war with the United States. It doesn't think that it will aid China. It doesn't think it will aid the United States at all. In Chinese terminology, it would constitute a lose-lose outcome. And therefore, it doesn't want it. Therefore, its optimal position is the U.S. does nothing, in which case China will do absolutely nothing. It's also indicated that provided that there is no attempt to block the strategic goals of China, which is really to achieve a high living standard. I mean, the purpose of developing China's higher technology industry and higher value added is not for its own sake. It's so that the Chinese people can get higher living standards, and for them to give up, as it appears to be the demand of the administration by its opposition to the program for industry to 2025, says, you know, that China should go back to, you know, producing, you know, toys and fireworks, etc. And that's completely unacceptable to the, not merely to the Chinese government, it's completely unacceptable to the Chinese people. You know, 1.3 billion people are not going to accept that they shouldn't have a very good standard of living. If that is not interfered with, then China will, okay, it can purchase more high-quality food from the United States, fruit, soybeans, other types of things. It can buy more cars and all those types of things, and it's willing to do those types of things. It wants to expand its own standard of living, and it wants to develop its own consumer market, and those things with the U.S. can fit in. What it will never accept is that China should remain a low-income economy because the United States wants to develop its prevent the development of China's economy. And no self-respecting country would, and certainly not one as powerful as China. And incidentally, in about 10 to 20 years' time, if the same thing is tried with India, well, the United States, India will give exactly the same response as China has.
Yeah. What do you think Trump wants from China?
And there has to be an end game here somewhere.
And also, maybe there's more than one, quote, Trump. If we have Peter Navarro, Wilbur Ross, Robert Lighthizer, the leading trade official. Peter Navarro, of course, is anti-China. Steven Mnuchin, representing Goldman Sachs and Wall Street bankers, said that a trade war was on hold 2 weeks ago. And then immediately Donald Trump was like, no, it's not. It's not on hold. We're going at it. And so, all the other utterances coming out of the White House or sectors of the White House, it makes it feel like that there's more than one voice. At one time, it seems like Steven Mnuchin is the top dog. Then the next day, Trump has changed and is now representing the views of Peter Navarro. So one is, how big of a debate is this within the White House? What does it represent in terms of U.S. sort of capital? In other words, where does Wall Street stand? Where does high-tech companies stand? Where does the military-industrial complex stand? And John Ross, what do the hawks want, the so-called anti-China hawks? What's their real goal here?
Well, I think there is very sharp differences, not merely for economic, for political reasons, because this policy, which this protectionist policy against China, is not merely against the interests of China. It's against the interests of the American consumers, the American workers. If you take, for example, the study that was done by Oxford Economics, which is a totally well-known mainstream Western economic organization, it's got nothing to do with China at all. Its estimate was that the cheap prices of imported goods from China saves the American family, average American household, about $850 a year, because the products produced in China are cheaper than the products that would be produced anywhere else. That's even before you get into the secondary effects, because, of course, the U.S. does not merely import finished consumer goods. It also imports what are called in technically intermediate products, that is, parts which are going into production and so on. And therefore, it'll put up the costs throughout the U.S. The study that was done, obviously, for example, on the tire industry, when the U.S. introduced tariffs, not specifically against China, just in general, was that each job that was saved directly in the tire industry cost about $1 million to the U.S. economy. It would be much cheaper to, you know, pay the subsidy to the U.S. Tire workers than it was to introduce this tariff. And also that the net effect was that it lost the U.S. 3,000 jobs. Because while it's true some jobs were created in the tire industry, the increased prices that then went into cars and other products meant that more jobs were lost in distribution and retail than were gained in the tire making industry. So therefore, this whole thing is an attack on the living standards of American people. Now, it's for that reason that in the first initial announcement on tariffs, Trump tried to be a bit clever, because if you really wanted to cut the trade deficit by tariffs with China, you'd go after things like mobile phones. which constitutes a huge part of the imports. But he understood that would be incredibly unpopular in the United States. You know, if you've got to suddenly pay more for your iPhone and other mobile phones, it's going to be very unpopular. So he tried to put the tariffs on other things. But doesn't really have all that much effect, because that will work through via, say, intermediate products or other things. So the reason that there is these contradictory tendencies is not merely economic. That is, doubtless the steel producers, for example, on steel, would like to have tariffs to protect the steel industry, or some of the things people who are affected by the China tariffs would like tariffs. But it's against the interests of the, not merely the U.S. economy, it's against the interests of the U.S. population. So it's going to be very politically unpopular. I mean, the soybean farmers, for example, in the U.S. are greatly up in arms, because, you know, everybody knows that the China will hit back against soybeans. And I know that, for example, the EU, with its tariffs, are going to hit back against Harley-Davidson. It's going to hit back against producers of Kentucky bourbon and things like that. So the reason that you quite rightly point out that all these contradictory views is not merely economic, it's also political.
All right. We're going to also be joined now by Rainer Braun. Rainer is joining us from Ramstein, Germany. Rainer is the co-president of the International Peace Bureau. Our other guest is John Ross. John is talking to us from the UK. John is an award-winning resident columnist with several Chinese media organizations, with over 200 articles published on China and the international economy. And John is also very active on Chinese social media, has 800,000 followers. So, John, we want to get back to you and talk a little bit more about Chinese people's sentiment, because the government in China, like the government anywhere, can't ignore, you know, public opinion, especially public opinion that's swaying in a particular direction. But let's turn now to Rainer Braun. Rainer, welcome.
Hello.
Let's talk about, again, let's go back, Rainer. You're in Germany. The U.S., I'm looking at a headline from RT website, U.S. about to slap disobedient European firms with sanctions over Russian gas project. This is about Nord Stream 2. The White House is on the verge of introducing penalties against European companies engaged in the construction of the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, which will deliver Russian natural gas to the EU across the Baltic Sea. Here we have the White House, America, telling Europeans where they can get their energy from. It must create a lot of resentment, not just from the corporations that are likely to lose business or be penalized for doing business with Nord Stream 2, but just with average German people.
You know, it is a more or less really stupid situation that we are now defending European companies. And, you know, the main point for me, this gas pipeline is a part of a politics of common interest and common security in Europe. It underlines the cooperative relations between Russia and Europe, above all between Russia and Germany. This is the reason I'm so much in favor of this pipeline. And, you know, what the U.S. is doing, they are only protecting their own gas, which they want to sell to the Europeans, which is much more expensive. And it is produced in a much more dangerous way. So we are absolutely in opposition to have these gas exported or imported from the U.S. to Europe. So, and the second point for me is, you know, we have several fights now about trade in the world. What we need in the world is a new trade system. You know, we don't need the traditional old trade system or free market, but we also don't need the protection trade system. We need really a system of justice trade in the world, helping the poor countries develop their economy, being on an equal way supporting the development of the countries. This is in the opposition to the politics of TTIP and other international trade agreements, but it's absolutely against the protection behavior of the U.S. government. So we are going for a third way, and this is the way of international global justice.
I hear you. Real quick, though, Rainer, before we go back to John, what's public opinion like in Germany over these threats from the Trump administration? Is it a big deal?
You know, when Trump would be the candidate in Germany, he would have got lost less than 5% votes.
He's lucky he's not there then.
Yeah, he could be lucky. You know, maybe he will also be in prison before all his criminal activities he has done and his criminal business. But this is another case. You know, and The Germans are deeply disappointed, and we are in a historical new situation. We never, even under Bush, had such a brutal opposition of all the political parties against the Trump administration. You know, in the Bush time, when Bush was going to the Iraq war, Germany was divided. The majority was against the war, but the Conservative Party was in favor of the war. Merkel was going to Bush and was saying, I'm in favor of the war. But in this time, everyone in Germany is against these horrible Trump politics. And this is a historical new situation in Europe. And, you know, when you were looking to the meeting of the financial ministers of the G7 countries, we never had such a situation that six were against one.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
This is historical new and shows a new situation. We will have new coalitions in the world, which hopefully will stop Trump destroying all international relations.
Okay, that's the voice of Rainer Braun. We're speaking to him from Ramstein, Germany. Rainer is the co-president of the International Peace Bureau. We're also talking with John Ross. John, let's just spend a minute or two about what Rainer said, and you alluded to it in the beginning of this interview. By the policies articulated, enacted, imposed by the Trump White House, attacking economically adversaries and allies alike has created this remarkable, what Rainer was saying, unprecedented new situation whereby the whole world is now has a common something in common, which is fierce opposition or dislike, at least, of what the Trump administration is doing. It seems to be such like a gratuitous renunciation of America's position as the global, whatever you want to call it, hegemon in the world. It does matter if the people of the world, people in Europe, people in China, people in Latin America, view the United States president with such enmity. Again, if that's all true, can we, as Rainer is suggesting, create new coalitions that haven't existed for the past decades, at least, in terms of world politics or the world economy?
Well, yes, but you've got to be clear. Trump's policy is not irrational. If you look at the fundamentals of the U.S. economy, it presents itself in propaganda or media or whatever you want to call it as incredibly dynamic economy. And it points to some individual companies which are very dynamic, Apple or Google or something, or you should be suspicious when only the same examples are pointed to all the time. But the reality is the U.S. economy has been slowing down for 50 years. If you go back to the late 1960s, it was growing average 4.2% a year. Now it grows at 2.2% a year. And there's no policy for speeding up the U.S. economy. The only policy that the U.S. has is to attempt to slow down other economies. And, you know, if an American president had a policy to speed up the U.S. economy, firstly, no one could complain about it. And secondly, no one would be able to do anything about it. But the policy that what you should do is slow down other economies is entirely unacceptable. And so, yes, you are getting a coalition. I don't think it's going to take necessarily overt geopolitical forms, because I've explained this would really require a big change in foreign policy in Europe. And I would be very happy if it took place, but I don't quite honestly believe it would in a very short time. But what there is going to be the case is countries are not going to allow themselves to be messed up. You know, the as I said, for Germany, China is now its biggest trading partner. You've got an excellent relationship between China and Germany. Germany exports very high-quality, high-tech machine tools to China. China exports back medium technology consumer goods, which Germany couldn't possibly produce as cheaply as China does. And this is highly satisfactory for both of them. Therefore, the Germany is not going to give in very easily to these situations. So I think without a big dramatic fuss, I mean, I think on the economic front, the characterization of the G7 meeting is it's really the G6 plus one is accurate. But I think you'll have a slight bit of a difference between where people will continue to look to the U.S. over military and other matters, and they'll be increasingly distant from it on economic questions, and there's going to be some distinction between these two.
John, I'd like to turn to Iran for a moment and talk about Iranian trade relations with China in light of the Trump administration's decision to pull out of the JCPOA. Has the Chinese government made any decision on whether or not to challenge these U.S. sanctions, unilateral sanctions against Iran, by continuing to trade with Iran? Or do you think that that the Chinese will end that trade relationship like it looks like the Europeans are going to do?
I don't think China will alter its economic relationships with Iran because of threats from the United States. Iran is an important trading partner. I mean, the situation over Iran is particularly cynical from the United States, and because the U.S. does virtually no trade with Iran. If my memory is correct, it's less than $1 billion a year, or significantly less than $1 billion a year, whereas Europe does substantial trade with Iran. And Iran is one of the major oil exporters to China, and I can't see China altering that position at all. I mean, that's just an attack on China. Maybe the Europeans will give in on this. They probably will do, but I don't believe that China will do that at all.
I'm wondering, too, how this is going to affect, or if it's going to affect, the U.S.-Chinese diplomatic relationship. As you say, it doesn't make sense for the Chinese to end trade relations with Iran when the United States is not going to take any kind of a financial hit by ending its trade relationship with Iran, which is minuscule. The Europeans, I think, are feeling greatly put out by this policy. They're feeling bullied. And I wonder if they would be willing to look east for leadership on this issue.
Well, I explain. I think you're in a medium-term difference as regards Europe, because Europe would have to have a change in foreign policy in order to deal with this. Europe has built itself on its relationship with the United States really since World War II. Now, in fact, the United States has used this economically against Europe, as, for example, it's not really in Europe's interest at all to have this division which exists with Russia. It's not in Europe's interest at all to have the division with Iran. So the U.S. has therefore used its military leverage to do damage to the European economies, or to slow down the European economies. But it would take a change not merely in economic policy, but in foreign policy, for Europe to break out of that. And that would be highly desirable, but it will probably take a little bit longer, because the hope that obviously Europe will have is that the Trump will be out of office in, what is it, about 30 months' time approximately, isn't it? And then things will return to normal. I don't think the matters are going to be that simple, not necessarily that Trump won't be out of office, but I think that the U.S. has got a very strategic problem, which is it can't speed up its economy. And therefore, the only way it can deal with any other country is to attempt to slow it down. So I think there's going to be strategic increasing problems between the U.S. and Europe, but I don't expect these all to be resolved in the next period, between now and Trump's next election, because that's what Europe is certainly hoping for. It would, I imagine, attempt to keep the ship afloat as much as possible and hope that Trump will be defeated at the next election and he'll have somebody more on the Obama-Clinton line will return to office.
I'm looking at the New York Times from today. Conservative Koch groups, that's the Koch brothers, plan pro-trade blitz as issue splits Republicans. The conservative Koch political network said on Monday that it would begin a multi-million dollar advertising campaign to promote free trade, sharpening a disagreement with President Trump over tariffs, and highlighting a growing rift between conservative donors and the Republican base on trade issues. That's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, John Ross. And again, if you want to comment on it, because what you're suggesting is, in essence, that there's a certain logic to the Trump program, which is the American government can't speed up and thus is trying to slow down other countries' economic growth. But here you have other key figures or key forces within the Republican Party who don't see it the way Trump is viewing it. From your point of view, and we have about 2.5 minutes left, what is the fundamental reason why the U.S. government or the U.S. economy in particular can't dynamically increase its pace of development?
It doesn't invest enough. It's very simple.
Is it a policy problem, in other words, a governance policy?
There's two things which If you reduce it to economic fundamentals, and then we'll look at what explains them, the U.S. economy produces, in net terms, very little capital. The net creation of capital, that is new capital minus depreciation, is under 3% in the U.S. economy. This is about one-third of the level that it was if you go back 40, 50 years. The economy can't grow very fast. Now, why is it so low? It's because there are two gigantically wasteful things in the United States. One is the level of military expenditure is far higher as a proportion of GDP than any other country. And in economic terms, military spending is a form of consumption. Therefore, that cuts into capital accumulation or investment. Secondly, the U.S. has an absurdly inefficient health service. It spends about 16% of GDP on health spending and has the lowest life expectancy of any major developed country. These are completely irrational policies which slow down accumulation in the U.S., but they're defended by massive interest groups, which is the military and the hawks within the U.S. and, you know, the private health lobby inside the United States. You would have to have tremendous structural changes in the U.S. to change this. And if you're not willing to do that, there's no way you can speed up the U.S. economy. You can temporarily borrow a lot of money from abroad, which is what Reagan did, which helped to lead the path to the international financial crisis, and which Trump could try to do. But the problem is, if you borrow money from abroad, you necessarily are going to have to import more goods from other countries, and that goes against his aim to cut the trade deficit. So he's got a completely contradictory policy. On the one hand, he's reducing savings even further in the U.S. by increasing the budget deficit. And on the other hand, he wants to cut the trade deficit. And those two just can't be fitted together. So therefore, the economy is not going to accelerate. And you can't do it without major political changes inside the U.S.
All right, John Kiriakou, to use your favorite expression, I think John Ross is exactly right. And I think it's a fascinating discussion and
Agreed. An
important, very, very important analysis that John has shared with us. We lost Reiner Braun because of a technical glitch. He was talking to us from Germany. We've been joined from UK by John Ross. He's an award-winning resident columnist with several Chinese media organizations. He has over 200 articles published on China and the international economy. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.